All right. Don't have microphones, so if you need to get closer, please do. If you can hear me fine. Thanks for finishing the class with us. Looking forward to wrapping it up tonight. I sent these out earlier by email, but nobody checks their email. So here's some reflective questions that I'd love to you guys think about throughout the night. I'd love to end tonight with just some thoughts from you. So, you know, what insight about God's character did you gain from studying Genesis? Maybe any insight that you feel like over the last few weeks that you gained? What story or passage stood out to you and why? Is there a theme or takeaway from the book of Genesis that helps you best understand the rest of the Bible? Maybe something that, because there's so many themes that first emerge in the book of Genesis that help us really understand the rest of the story of God and the whole. So maybe something like that. Or were there any parts of Genesis that were challenging or raised questions for you? Hopefully we didn't destroy anybody's faith or anything like that. If we did, please come see me. But I also think that it's really good to wrestle through difficult texts and not shy away from it. It's okay to ask hard questions. That's one of the things that even in my upbringing as a kid, it was like, you know, it's like, well, at the end of the day, you just believe. And really what it meant was don't ask the hard questions. But the hard questions are okay to ask, right? We got to wrestle through those and do it faithfully and do it struggle well is what I'd say. So we'll end with this tonight. So maybe thinking about something, one of those that you want to share. So let's jump in. This is obviously a massive chunk of text that we're dealing with tonight. We can't cover every story, so we're going to hit the highlights, and then we'll stop and kind of talk. So we've been now in, we did the kind of the primeval first part of Genesis 1 through 11. Then last week we got into Abraham and even Isaac, which is kind of more the patriarchal part of the story. It's following the lineage of how did Israel begin. So again, I know I've said it every week, but we're talking 6th century BC. They're in exile, coming out of exile. They're writing and compiling the Pentateuch, the first 5 books of the Bible. So all these stories have been circulating for a long time. They're compiling and putting them together for the people of Israel, right? Let me tell you the story of the beginning, the story of Israel, the story of God's faithfulness, his covenant that's been with you from the beginning, right? And it was about two things, people and land, people and land. And so God is establishing the people of Israel. Genesis is a lot about how did we get Israel? And so we're going to cover that in just a minute. Where did Israel come from? And then Exodus is about becoming God's people, the law, what your behavior, but also about the land. So obviously Exodus is taking us up to the promised land. So those two things, God is going to establish a covenant through a people and a land, and that becomes a significant part of this story. So we're going to jump in Genesis 23. Last week we left off with Abraham putting Isaac on the altar, going to make a sacrifice because God asked him to, you know, and then God spares his life. And we kind of end with this idea, you know, God spared Isaac, but did not spare his own son and gave what was most precious to him. So in Genesis 23, you have the death of Sarah. And here's what happens in this passage. And remember, so much of this is about telling the people of Israel much later how we got there, why your enemies are your enemies, like who was blessed and who wasn't, right? And it's all about land. So by purchasing land in Canaan from the Hittites, Abraham established the first foothold in the land God had promised to give his descendants. So you think about this being a huge step of faith. Sarah dies. Abraham goes to the land that he believes God's going to promise and give the people of Israel. And he actually buys a plot of land in the middle of it. Remember, it's not his land. The Hittites own it because he says, I'm going to bury Sarah here because all of our descendants will be back and will own this land one day. Like, this is a huge move of faith, right? This is a baller move. Come on, right? And so this is one of those, it's like, I'm not going to see, there you go. I'm not going to see it in my life, but my ancestors will own this. And our graves will be here. So it's almost like Abraham declaring this sign of faith even before they had it, before it was a reality, right? So buying a burial site in this land was an act of faith by Abraham that this wasn't just a temporary dwelling space, but his family's future home. God will be faithful to future generations, right? God believes the promise and the covenant to be true, and that eventually his family will all be buried here next to him in a land that will be their own. So that's significant in our story. Then we get to Isaac and Rebekah, Genesis chapter 24. And it's kind of in this story, we're going to go through these patriarchs, and we're going to cover quite a few of them today. Obviously, Abraham is one of the main three characters in the entire Old Testament. Then we get Isaac. Isaac, you get like no information about Isaac. He's like a non-factor, like a non-character in all of this. Then we're about to get a ton about Jacob, and we're going to get a long story about Joseph. But Isaac is kind of just one of those buffer characters. It's not that he did anything wrong. He seemed to be a man of faith and integrity. You just don't get much about his life. And so Genesis 24 is a story where they're going to find a wife for Isaac. And Abraham, again, says, we can't find a wife from Isaac for the land that we live in because everybody are worshiping other gods, right? What we have to do is we have to send, we have to go back to my home, right, where our family is, people who seem to be serving Yahweh, and we're going to find a wife for Isaac there. So you remember, this is the story where they send the servant, where Abraham says to the servant, I want you to go back to our family and go look for someone who's going to be faithful, right? Why did Yahweh in the Old Testament prohibit intermarriage between pagan cultures? Because it inevitably led to spiritual infidelity. Like the moment that you invited or married someone, we always think that, oh, we'll rub off on them. But how many know that's not the case? It always led to spiritual idolatry. And you see this all through, I mean, Solomon is the perfect example. And over again, you would bring in people. And so Abraham, in his wisdom, really in faith, said, we're going to go back and we're going to find a wife for you. Devotion to a non-Israelite wife could easily lead to abandoning the ways of Yahweh. Abraham knew, if we abandon the ways, right, then this covenant won't be fulfilled for us. And so that's where you find Rebekah. The servant finds Rebekah, who's at the well. And the passage highlights the faith of Abraham, the servant, and Rebekah in the face of difficulty and uncertainty. So like if you get into the weeds of that story, it's a squirrely story. But they find Rebekah. So let's keep going one more here. And we'll stop. You have Abraham's death, and then you have the birth of Jacob and Esau. So again, Isaac is just really a non-factor, a non-character. The descendants of Abraham, you have Isaac, you have Ishmael, you have a bunch of sons of concubines. And so remember, the law has not been given yet. So these are, I mean, Abraham was polytheistic more than likely, worshiped many gods. Now he becomes monotheistic. But you can tell, like, there's still a lot of issues. Like, there's still struggle. How do we live? And so, you know, you have Abraham had children, Isaac through Sarah. He had Ishmael, remember, through Hagar, because he didn't want to wait on the promise. And so that's when Sarah was like, take my servant, Hagar, and he had Ishmael. Ishmael and Isaac will be at war and at odds their whole life. And today, who is Israel always at war with? The Arab nations, the descendants of Ishmael. So here we are thousands of years later, and they're still at war. And then here's what we don't want to talk about, this man of faith. He had a bunch of concubines, and he had a bunch of kids with a bunch of different women because that was culturally acceptable, right? So God has not established all of this yet through the law. And so you have our men and women of God who are going to do weird, crazy things. And if you think Abraham's crazy, just wait till we get to Jacob. In just a minute. I mean, Jacob is absolutely jacked up in every way. I mean, and I think sometimes we don't read the story for what it is. I mean, if you read the story of Jacob, it's crazy. So Isaac and Rebekah give birth to twins. And it says in Genesis chapter 25, the two nations are in your womb and two people from within you shall be divided and the older shall serve the younger. That becomes a theme for the entire Old Testament. And I couldn't exactly tell you why. I'm sure there's some theological implication, but you have that becoming a theme. Some of these themes of divine election, this makes us uncomfortable, but sometimes God chooses who God chooses, and he's sovereign and we're not. You have a lot of the reversal of human expectations. God doesn't have to operate in a way that fits within your rationale or your way of thinking. And you see that come up in the Old Testament, which can be uncomfortable for people. You have a struggle between Israel, Jacob, and Edom, which is Esau. And so that's a continual struggle that we talked about. So all of this is now emerging as well. So then we get Jacob's journey, starting really in chapter, they're born in the end of chapter 25, and starting in Genesis 26. And for the entire first half of Jacob's life, he is a trickster, he is a liar, he is a deceiver, he manipulates, he does things. Like when you begin to, like, I encourage you just to like go through and read the text, because sometimes I think we just forget. Like we hear the stories growing up, but we forget. Like when Jacob goes out to meet Esau many chapters later, it literally says he puts his slaves out in front so they'll get killed first. Then he puts Leah, because Leah's his least favorite wife, and all of her kids. And then he puts Rachel in the back. Like this is the kind of man that Jacob is. And he's in the very back because he's like, I think Esau is going to kill us all, right? Great guy. Yeah, really, really phenomenal human being. But this is what we get. Jacob deceives Isaac. This is the story of selling your birthright. In the first few chapters here of this story, what's going to happen? Jacob is going to take Esau's birthright, and then he's going to trick his dad and take his blessing. Like the two things that were due to Esau. And the first time, Esau, he's an idiot. He sells it, right, for a bowl of stew. You remember that story? He's famished and he comes in. Now Rebekah, this great woman of faith that was chosen for Isaac, she's kind of playing the game. She wants Jacob, her son, to be blessed and not really Esau. So she's into this whole deception. And it is just a messed up story. I mean, really every part of it for about four or five chapters. Jacob comes to Bethel in Genesis chapter 28. This is where he has the dream of the staircase going to heaven. This really, the only reason this is part of the Old Testament, it's not even so much about Jacob. It's telling the people of Israel later why Bethel is a holy place. It's a holy place because Jacob stopped there and received this dream from God. And really everything good that happens in Jacob's life is because of God's commitment to the people of Israel. It's not because of him. If it was because of him and his behavior, I think God would have been like, I'm out. You know, see ya. It's like, no, I want to be faithful to your grandfather, Abraham. And so that's why I'm continuing to show you grace and favor with you over and over again. And he recommits his promise to bless Jacob, you know, in all of this. So Jacob's dream at Bethel, how did Bethel become a prominent city known as the House of God? That becomes a major holy place, again, for Israel later on. So if you're writing later on, you want to go back and tell the people the story. This is why Bethel was holy from the beginning, because Jacob met God there and had this encounter. Then you get another crazy story, Genesis 29 of Jacob and Laban. This is the story of how Jacob got his wives, right? Plural. Everybody's got multiple wives, multiple kids with multiple wives all over the place. And so I'm not going to go through all the story. You probably remember some of it. This is where, being the great man that he is, he sees Rachel. She's beautiful. I want her. And what does Laban do? Laban sends Leah in. So that in those days, you would literally go into the tent and consummate your marriage that night, but you wouldn't see the face of your wife. And so he sends Leah in instead of Rachel. He consummates the marriage with Leah. The next morning, wakes up to find that it's Leah, not Rachel. What a great wedding gift, right? Goes to Laban. What did you do? The trickster gets tricked, right? The deceiver is deceived. I mean, it's a little bit funny because you're like, Jacob, you have it coming. Like everybody in your life, you deceive and you trick, and now you have somebody who's done this for you. And yeah, a little karma coming back around there. So
all this is still fair play.
Yeah. Well, again, is Does God approve of this? No. But this is part of God's grace in this moment, especially because the law has not been given, right? So multiple marriage was, you know, this is one of those moments that even theology, like where God shows up and people are trying to understand who God is through the lens of their own culture, right? We understand because these are normalized for us. And so this is one of those questions, well, why did God allow like polygamy? Well, that was not God's desire. We see that even from the beginning of the Genesis story. But does God allow it in this circumstances until he reveals more of who he is and more truth? Ultimately, Moses is going to receive the law, right? And then everybody's going to realize, okay, this is not the way.
So is there then, I mean, as we read this, is there a natural progression because the law hasn't been written and all these things are going on, and then, you know, you have to take like the New Testament, when they're going, I can't remember who it is, goes with Jesus, goes to him and said, they were asking about, he'd given up everything, and he said, did you really give it all up? And, you know, he lied to him, said he kept a little bit back, and boom, he was gone.
Yeah. Right then. Ananias and Sapphira.
Yeah. So, I mean, take that from one extreme, you just lied to him right then and there, and your life's over.
Yeah.
Compared to what they were,
You just happen to name a story that's kind of an anomaly in the New Testament. Ananias and Sapphira, you don't see that happening a whole lot. But there is this idea of, again, we talked about progressive revelation and that God progressively reveals who he is. So like, let's take marriage, for example. God established a precedent in Genesis of the covenant of marriage between man and woman. But the unraveling effects of sin on society, now polygamy is normalized, right? Was that God's desire? No. But God shows up to Abraham in the context in which he lives, which polygamy is normalized, and he's going to lead them to this understanding over generations that that's not the way. And, you know, part of it is, look at what happens when you practice this. Like, the writers show you this. This is not God's desire because every person who practices it, it causes them pain and harm, and those people end up becoming the people that stand in the way of Israel. Right? Like, I'm with you in just a minute. Yeah. And so that's a huge point that the writer's trying to make. Look what happens when you take Hagar. Like even the concubines that Abraham would take, those would not be the people of Israel. They would stand in the way. So he's even trying to show you like this is the result of sin and disobedience. It never produces the result that you want it to, right?
So, you know, he gets so frustrated in Genesis 11 that he has the blood.
Right.
It seems like we keep failing.
Yeah.
And even his clothes related to this.
Yeah.
But there's not another flood. I mean, what?
Right.
Is that the progressive, like, does he grow in patience? Does he?
No, and I think you were gone the week that we did. So if you remember, after the flood, God says, I'm not going to deal with my people ever again this way.
Oh, okay.
So now I'm going to establish a covenant. So even in their wickedness, I'm going to persist in my faithfulness to them to win them back. So the flood is really about, there was a flood story obviously circulating. So it's their way of making sense of what happened. But yeah, but you do have this. I mean, it's some crazy stuff here. And so, yeah, Leah, yeah, go ahead.
Well, one thing after the flood, one thing that God did was he shortened man's lifespan.
Mm. Yeah, they don't live as long after that. So Leah, How does it describe her? Weak eyes. Come on. At one point, it was like Rachel's beautiful and Leah has weak eyes, which is the backhanded way the Bible is telling you, like one was really beautiful and one was not, and Jacob definitely treated them differently. Huh?
He still managed to have kids.
Yeah, he did. So Leah was very fertile, and of course Rachel was barren. That's how it always tends to work. It's amazing in these stories how many of the women were barren. And then when they did produce, they produced the heir, the descendant that would ultimately be the line of Israel. And so there's a theme in here of waiting on God and obedience. Like those are waiting on God's timing, not producing an Ishmael in your own timing, and then obedience. Because it was the disobedience and the lack of lack of patience that caused, you know, a lot of the greatest suffering. Leah has a lot of children. Rachel eventually produces two children, which become Joseph and Benjamin. Who does Jacob, who becomes Israel later, love the most? He loves Joseph and he loves Benjamin, right? A lot of favoritism, a lot of things there. So this whole story of Jacob and Laban's interaction is honestly, it's pathetic. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. Like, we can try to make it sound better. They're constantly tricking each other. Even Laban gets Jacob to stick around for like 20 years. Then Jacob's like, I'm done with this, takes up all of his stuff and leaves. And Laban follows him, probably going to take him out until an angel or some kind of being shows up to Laban and says, nope, don't do that. I mean, God is like protecting Jacob just because Jacob is the lineage for the people of Israel, right? So it says in here, absolute chaos and dysfunction. And this is when we begin to get this. This is huge in the book of Genesis in the Old Testament. This word, hesed, right? It's steadfast love. So God is going to display his faithfulness to the covenant, his hesed. He's going to stick with his people no matter what. This is when we really get the relentless. You see this relentless love of God that is undeserved. And everything's a mess, but God is sticking with his people, and he's going to stay true to what he said. Then we get a very significant passage, Genesis 32. So I would highlight this. Oh, you know, going back real quick, I know I said it was jacked up, but like, I'll give you Genesis 30, for example. Leah is bearing sons. Eventually, she stops being able to. She offers her servant, Bilhah. Then Rachel offers her servant, Zilpah. I mean, Jacob's having kids with all of these women, right? And then Laban apparently is worshiping images and other gods. And so in one part of this story, Rachel literally steals the idols out of his home, and Laban's searching the camp trying to find his stolen idols. I mean, this is messed up, right? It's reminiscent of, to me, I go back of like the Noah story, like everyone did evil in their own eyes. But here they are, supposedly the people of God. And it just shows you God's faithfulness to not wipe them off the face of the planet again, because it was crazy. Jacob eventually flees Laban. Jacob and Esau are on a collision course to meet. We only assume Esau's ticked, right? Jacob, just like you and I would probably think, like, my brother's going to kill me. Jacob had become very wealthy at that point. He had accumulated a ton of cattle and all of these things. He's like, I'm going to go and I'm going to send this huge gift to Esau. In the middle of this is the turning point in Jacob's life. Genesis chapter 32, verse 22, Jacob encounters God in a deeply personal and transformative way. Jacob is given a new name. His new name is what?
Israel.
Israel, right? So here we get the people of Israel. Meaning he who struggles with God, what an appropriate name, or God prevails. And so this is that moment where this unnamed individual comes in the middle of the night and they wrestle, right? There's a wrestle. So this is moving from a life defined by self-reliance and deception to a life marked by divine encounter and blessing. This theme, which I find extremely powerful, transformation through struggle. Transformation through struggle. Isn't that true? Jacob will walk with a permanent limp as a reminder of Jacob's dependence on God. And so now there seems to be something different about Jacob. From this point forward, it's just different. We don't get the trickster. Now all of a sudden we get a man that seems to be more full of wisdom. there's a message in here of leaders who walk with a limp, right? I don't know about you, but I prefer to follow somebody who walks with a little bit of a limp because it shows that there's been a wrestling, a struggling. And it's not if we struggle, it's do we struggle well, right? How does that transform us? What do we come out on the other side in the struggle? And I mean, this is a powerful story of just Jacob's struggle. I do want to bring this up. There is some sort of a mystery around this divine encounter that Jacob had. Was this God? Was this Christ in the Old Testament? Stretch. Was it an angelic being? One of my really good friends in college did his senior paper and presented that he believed that this is Esau. And it actually went on to be, it was one of the best probably senior paper in our class, in the theology class. And it went on to actually be quoted in journals, because in the very next chapter, Jacob meets Esau. And he says, "For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me." So Jacob literally looks at Esau and he says, "Your face is like the face of God." Well, the night before, he just wrestled with an unnamed man that seemed to be like a godlike figure. And so there's a reference there that, like, maybe Esau came in the middle of the night and they wrestled. I'm not saying he did. I just think it's fun to talk about. So most people just assume that this is some sort of divine being, right? Now, in saying that, could Jacob really have held off a divine being that eventually, you know, tapped out? I don't know. But he was blessed. Sure.
Was Esau still alive?
Yes. Okay. So in the next chapter, after this wrestling, Jacob and Esau meet.
But he's still alive.
He's still alive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Any other thoughts, questions on this? So we don't really understand or know exactly who this is, but we know that it was transformative for Jacob. We know that he walked with this limp, but it was a defining moment.
Hey, Matt.
Yep.
You know, you call that a mystery, or it's referred to as a mystery. But one of the things that I've picked up on in this, specifically this class, is the writers are giving us what the points that they want to make.
For sure.
And if they didn't call this opponent out, give him a name or something other than I looked it up.
Yeah.
But so is his opponent relevant? Or is it just a wrestling?
Yeah.
Has it just been a, you know, him carrying on a conversation in the dark by himself, and I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a stretch, but it's been pointed out that we're only given what we need to know to take the story forward.
For sure.
Quit trying to write things in.
Yeah.
Extrapolate.
Yeah, especially when we're actually dealing with, you know, what can we take from this? Now, it's fun to, hey, what was Paul's thorn in the flesh? Well, you weren't given that, so you ultimately don't know. So take what you're given. So it can be fun to have those conversations, but sometimes those conversations take up 98% of the time, and we miss what the text actually says, right? Yeah. And this one, Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then he said, "This man, let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." This is the same Jacob, if you remember, when he was born and wrestled with Esau in the womb. Esau was this manly man, and Jacob was like the cook. Jacob, you know, was never this, you know. So this is a role reversal for Jacob. Like, all of a sudden, like, Jacob, the trickster who's always tried to get something by tricking people and taking advantage of them, now is like, I'm going to get this the hard way, and I'm going to wrestle with this man or with God, and I'm not going to let go. Like, you just see a transformation, right? It's just almost like it's a different person. And what does the man say? Then he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and men and have prevailed." So Jacob asked several times what your name is, but he wouldn't say what his name was. So, you know, it's just interesting. It's an interesting story, but it's a story of transformation. So, any other thoughts on that? I do use that story a lot just in regards to leadership, the transformation of leadership in our life, and allowing brokenness to transform you, right? Through your pain and through wrestling with God. And, you know, a level of maturity comes after you do. You know, you walk with a limp, been through brokenness, have seen God's, you know, faithfulness, and it changes the way that you see life, the way that you lead. And if we allow it, God will use all of that pain and transform it in significant ways for others. So, Jacob Israel settles near the city of Shechem, near Canaan, where he buys a parcel of land, digs a well, and builds an altar to Yahweh. And so again, this is kind of a picture of him moving closer to the land that God has established for them. And that's really the gist of Genesis 33 through 35. There's a really bizarre story, Dinah, which is Jacob's daughter, who is taken advantage of by the people of the land. It's we won't get into all that at the moment, so can't get into every little thing. Then we move into this last part. Israel is saved. So if you've been following along on this episode of Genesis, we started with Adam. We went to Seth, not following the line of Cain. Abel's no longer with us. Following the line of Seth, then the line of Noah, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And honestly, it's a few chapters later, in chapter 35, God appears to Jacob again at this holy place and said to him, your name is Jacob no longer. You should be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. And so he reiterates the covenant, and now all of a sudden we have Jacob who becomes Israel. Now you see the unfolding of the people of God. Now the people of God are being established, right? How is God going to bring redemption to the world? He's going to start with a people and a land, and now the people are being formed, which is one of the main purposes of Genesis, which is one of the main purposes of a 6th century group of people who are struggling to know, how did we start? What was God's promises, right? God was true to his promises then. He's going to be true to his promises now. You get this crazy, bizarre theme of displaced older sons and brothers. Cain, Ishmael, Esau. It's the older brother who always gets passed up by the younger brother over and over again. And it's crazy that it's a consistent theme in the book of Genesis. You get this theme of sibling rivalry, started with Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau. We're about to get it with Joseph and his brothers. So more than likely, this is a theme that why would the history writers and the people compiling this do this? They want to show you that this tension of division and rivalry has been there from the beginning, and it's going to continue. The 12 tribes of Israel are going to be divided. Eventually, the kingdom is going to be divided. Remember, it's going to be a southern kingdom of Judah and a northern kingdom of Israel. And so it's going to be a theme in Israel's life of being divided. I'm not going to actually go really in depth into the life of Joseph. It is a story that, even though it speaks to the bigger picture, it gives us a lot of details. It's one of my favorite stories in all of Scripture. But I'm just not going to go into all the details of it. But the life of Joseph is ultimately put there to save Israel, right? If we go over to Genesis 45, 7 through 8. What does Joseph ultimately say to his father and brothers? This is after he's prince over Egypt. He's now saved them from famine. He could have been bitter. He could have been hurtful because he got sold into slavery. He says this, "And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God." Like that's why we get the Joseph story right there. And again, I know I see this over and over again, but if you're in the 6th century and you're reading this for the first time, God will always preserve a remnant to keep Israel going, right? God's never going to fully abandon you. Even in exile, he's going to rescue you, right? This is a story of, look at God's faithfulness time and time again. God would raise up a person, a people group. God always steps in to save Israel, and this is now no different, right? This is If you're reading this in the 6th century, this is all building your faith because you see God's faithfulness, this thread running through Genesis. Jacob, or now Israel, blesses Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. God blesses the younger over the older, who will become the northern kingdom of Israel. I don't know why the younger always gets blessed, but it was. And then Jacob or Israel blesses his son Judah, who will become the southern kingdom of Israel. And so those two people who are blessed end up becoming the two nations of Israel once they're divided. Obviously, we know from messianic literature in the Bible, all Israel's hope are in a king from Judah, right? So all signs are pointing to David. And then ultimately, even beyond there, into Christ, into Jesus, who would be from the line of Judah. Questions about that? And I know I didn't go into the details of Joseph, but I'm maybe just assuming that you know the story.
Like you just said, Jesus is from the line of Judah. How does that play to kind of what you've been saying of the obedience is where Israel and Israel's hopes follows, and where disobedience comes in, that's where things like the Ishmaelites and everything split off. But when you look at it compared to Jacob having the 10 children with Leah, as opposed to Rachel, in my mind, I consider Leah and her children the disobedient part in that, for that dynamic, and Rachel the obedient part, and yet the kingdom of Judah is was Leah's daughter or son.
Yeah,
is where Christ and David and all of that come through. Am I kind of mixing up what the obedience and disobedience would be?
In that particular instant, Leah's relationship was not a result of disobedience, right? He got tricked. So in this instance, there's not like a obedience and disobedience line with Leah and Rachel. So I probably did skip over this, but he has 10 kids with Leah and 2 with Rachel, 12 sons who become what? 12 tribes of Israel, right? So this is a part of God establishing the people of Israel. They become the extension of all of Israel. They will soon now go out into Israel and lead and be kind of the ruler or the governor over each of these 12 tribes, right? So this is one of way of God's establishing his people. And so, I mean, these sons who sell Joseph into slavery, these become the extensions and the leaders of the 12 tribes. We obviously know that in the 12 tribes, the tribe of Judah, there's a messianic line that's going to follow that. When I say messianic line, you remember when you're in the Old Testament, the messianic line for them started with David before it ever came to Jesus. Like, they don't know to anticipate Jesus until much later, right? They're looking for a king who's going to rise up and lead his people with righteousness, right? In the ways of God, which David is the closest depiction that we get that in the entire Old Testament of someone who did that well, right? So you're exactly right. A lot of times there was a line of obedience and disobedience. In this instance, Leah and Rachel, it was just one was preference and not, but it wasn't disobedience and obedience in that particular scenario. Yeah, good question.
And Judah wasn't a picture of righteousness because he was with prostitutes all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Again, messy story. God's, his hesed, the Hebrew word, his steadfast love now comes on display. So a lot of people are like, oh, grace is not as evident in the Old Testament. No, it absolutely is. There's so many times where if it wasn't for God's relentless love to hold on to his people, things would have, fallen off tracks a long, long time ago. So.
General question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In the lineage that go to some of those chapters, where you can't pronounce any of those names, I remember someone way back when said, you say them with authority and somebody will be like, okay, that's how it's pronounced.
Did you hear that from me?
I did.
Okay.
Anyway, are those all men being named?
Yeah. I mean, you'll have some women every once in a while.
My question, I guess, is all of these people that are, I mean, you know, the only sheep and have kids, that's what they seem to do.
Right.
But they all seem to be guys. And I'm like, do they not have any girls, or did they just not name the ladies because it wasn't important to the story?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's a patriarchal society. So again, you know, is it because God establishes a precedent of only using men? No, it's because that's how the society operated. Also, you look in the New Testament and the genealogy you get, who's included in the lineage of Jesus? Several women, right? So one of the times when people want to advocate for females shouldn't be in leadership, I always say go back to every episode and scene in the Bible from Old Testament and New Testament. Did God use or pour out a spirit on women? Were they empowered for ministry? Were they used in significant ways? In every episode of the Bible, it's always yes, right? Always.
Correct.
Yeah. So for us to be able to say, well, it was established from the beginning, that, you know, to me is just faulty, right? So it is. But it was culturally, right,
well,
what it was.
Like we were talking about they had 12 kids. What were they just, are those the 12 that they named? Could they have another, was there another 20 people that didn't feel like they need to be named because they weren't first 12 or 10 and 2. Okay, you're the
Well, I mean, and again, they're telling the story, so they're telling you the people that they think matter to the story. So Abraham has all these concubines and all these kids, and it actually says that he gives them gifts and sends them off to a far land. So he's like, yep, you don't really matter to the story.
Okay.
Go to the far land. Okay, Isaac, you matter, and Ishmael, I'm going to tell you because it's significant to the, it's just he's giving you, right, what you need to know. It sounds flippant, like they don't matter, but, you know, the story is being told for a certain purpose.
And we know that Jacob did have at least one daughter with Leah because it talks about Dinah.
Yeah, I'm sure there was other ones. Yeah, I don't think they were all just boy-making machines, you know, but we just don't get them in the story.
That's what it reads like. They just only knew how to make boys.
Yeah, it probably wasn't, but yeah, we're only given what we're given.
I think I should know this, but I don't. What's the significance of the 12 tribes besides just, you know, emphasizing that the lineage from Judah will continue further?
Yeah, I mean, those 12 tribes carry on through the life of Israel and become significant for their organization. There are times where the 12 tribes are divided in different groups, but then it's how God organized his people in the promised land. So again, I mean, it's like, this is not a great representation, but we're the 50 United States in America, right? So they were, you know, it was like their way of governing their section. And then God did certain things through certain tribes, and they had different purposes. And so you had a certain tribe who would be over this, like the Levites, who would be in charge of... Say it again.
Priests.
Yeah. And so there's a term that's eluding me right now. So they did have certain roles, right, to play in this. I don't hear much about that in like modern Israel today. It's a good question. Nothing comes to mind like in my time there, but there may be.
What was the question?
Are the 12 tribes have any significance for today in Israel?
Does the rabbi still come from the tribe of Levi?
I mean, that's the priesthood, yeah. I mean, they don't not all rabbis come from that tribe. That's mostly the priesthood, but yeah. I couldn't tell you the modern significance. Huh?
Israel like states like we do?
No. I mean, they're all unified pretty much. I mean, they have, you know, there's different settlements, but now it's pretty much one nation. Yeah. They may still know which tribes they originate from. I wouldn't doubt it. But any other questions in general over what we've covered here? Story. Again, Joseph is my favorite story. I just didn't get into all the details. Obviously, how does this story end? Israel, all of his sons, come to Egypt, right? It's kind of ironic is that in Genesis, they're saved by coming into Egypt, and in Exodus, they're going to be saved by what? Yeah. And so it's a reversal. And so we get the end of the story that Israel, Jacob, comes to Egypt and he's blessed. All of the people of Israel flourish there. God saves his people. And the story ends, right? And then all of a sudden we pick up in Exodus and what's happened? Generations have passed. Yep. New leaders come along. No longer respecting. Joseph's now long gone. What he's done has died out. And now they're in slavery. And so God is going to have to rescue his people once again. And this is going to be the salvation event of the Old Testament, of God redeeming and rescuing his people out of slavery, you know, into the promised land. But they have to take a lot of detours before they get there, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me bless us. Thanks for being a part of the last 4 weeks. I hope it was helpful. If there's anything I can do to help you, hope I didn't screw anybody up. Hopefully it was helpful overall. I enjoy it. I enjoy talking to theology staff.
So. Yeah,
we'll do more. Books of the Bible.
Start next week.
Book of Revelation. We have to, right? We did the beginning. Let's just do the end. Just put a bookend on it. Yeah, you guys read the middle. All right. Let me bless you. Father, thank you for these people. Thank you for your word. Thank you for what was passed down to us. And God, more than anything, Father, I pray that we would see the heart of God in Scripture, a God that is for his creation, a God that is for us, a God that relentlessly pursues us with his steadfast love and is faithful. And is faithful all the way through the Old Testament to give us Jesus, the ultimate example and the ultimate sacrifice for us. And so, Father, we're so thankful. I pray, Lord, that we would be good stewards of the knowledge that we had, that it would lead us closer to you and not in pride and selfishness, Father. Just bless each and every one of these individuals here tonight. We pray over them in Jesus' name. Amen.